From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. Elsa Chang, host of NPR's All Things Considered, is one of the top broadcast journalists in the nation. She's won numerous awards and accolades and became the first ever Asian American woman to host public radio's flagship program. But for much of her youth and young adulthood, journalism and certainly public media was never the plan. A talented student who graduated from Stanford University and Stanford Law School, Chang was all set to live the life of a powerful attorney in California. Until one day, she came to the realization that she would so much rather spend her days filing stories than filing law briefs. Today on the show, we turn the tables on this stellar interviewer and ask her about her life and work. She graciously joined KLCC to headline our event, Raising Our Voices, and today you'll hear from a voice that brings the news to millions of Americans in the evening. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. A sign of a true professional is someone who can do extremely difficult things but make them look easy. On today's show, you'll hear from a trailblazing journalist, Elsa Chang, whose intellect, personality, and drive combine to make an incredibly challenging occupation look effortless. NPR's All Things Considered host, Elsa Chang, in studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, it's such a pleasure.
You were so good enough to join us with our Amplifying Oregon Voices campaign the other night, and you killed. If there had been a spot election for Eugene Mayer, you would have won hands down.
I doubt it, but thank you very much for saying that.
But I think one of the reasons why the audience loved you so much is you had this great, I'll call it an origin story of how you made a very, very drastic career change. Talk about that. Take us through the Elsa Chang origin story, the pre-Marvel universe origin story.
Origin story of like how I became a journalist.
There you go.
There's another origin story, which is how I came to be, but we won't get into that. So I used to be a lawyer for several years. Mm-hmm. I graduated from Stanford Law School in 2001. And my entire life growing up, I was convinced, I knew I wanted to be a lawyer because I was in this, my parents, they're Taiwanese immigrants. Mm-hmm. They, like a lot of other Asian immigrant parents, want their kids to do something that's lucrative and stable with their life. Mm-hmm. And I was that weirdo in my family who loved words. Everybody else in my family, they're like science people.
Sure.
Math people, computer science people, or actual like chemistry science people. And I loved words. So my parents would always just say like, oh, you're clearly going to be a lawyer, as if that were the only choice available for someone who loved words. And I really adopted that. I wasn't pushed into that. I totally internalized that. I was in competitive speech and debate in high school, loved it. I also just loved the drama of the courtroom when, as a little girl watching Legal Eagle movies, I could see
LA
myself.
Law.
Yes, or LA Law TV shows. Like, I could see myself literally holding court in a mm-hmm. courtroom. But what I didn't figure out at that age, or really throughout law school, is who did I want to help exactly with my law degree? What issues animated or activated me enough to make a law career something that was meaningful and fulfilling? I never resolved those questions in my head because they weren't front of mind. I loved law school. I loved clerking. I clerked on the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco for a wonderful judge. And then I went to a law firm, a large law firm in California. And I immediately could tell that it was a weird fit. Why? Well, there were just like aspects of my job that I felt didn't tap into the parts I liked best about myself. I'm a very curious person. I'm a very free-flowing person. Like when I'm meeting people, I love to get to know them, and I'm very open. I don't have like a lot of much to the chagrin of people who know me, I don't have like a lot of privacy concerns. I just talk very openly about myself. And I just didn't quite fit in at the law firm. I wanted to like follow my curiosities. But it took me several years to get the courage to quit, because up until then, I had always been someone who lived life according to the plan.
Yeah.
I checked the boxes. I lived according to the track that was laid out for me. And I was very good at that. I was very, as I say, very excellent at excelling. It was kind of, you know, I always got good grades as a kid. So the thought of leaving the law firm was just like so alien to me, because I ditched the goal, the years-long goal. But by about year five into being a lawyer, I knew that I was just, I was not happy. I was depressed, to be completely honest, being a lawyer. I did not want to go to work. And I knew I needed a change of pace, a change of something to kind of wake up again. Because I felt like I was just going through life in a daze. So I quit. I gave the firm, I think, 1 week's notice. I still remember. It was like June 30th, 2006. I had no plan. And I just kind of like hung around San Francisco for a few months, not knowing what I was going to do to my life. And I decided, after months of just kind of like bumming around, having nothing to do, feeling sorry for myself, having nowhere to go day to day except, I don't know, read a book at the cafe, hang out with friends when they had time after they got out of work, I finally decided to sign up for an internship at KQED in San Francisco, the member station in San Francisco.
Sure.
Not because I thought I was going to go into radio, but because I was just like, oh, well, maybe if I'm around like down-to-earth smart people, I can figure out my life, but I need somewhere to go each day. I'm someone who likes to be needed.
Yeah.
And I loved that internship. I loved being able to prep hosts before their interviews, do quick research on all kinds of different stories, pre-interview potential guests. I loved the free ticket. I had to call up anybody in the universe and just ask them, what makes you interesting? What interesting things do you have to say? Yeah. You tell me what you have to offer. I loved that. And I loved the challenge of helping people sound like their most interesting selves, coaxing themselves out of their shells.
Yeah.
And I just loved all the things that were involved in being a journalist. So I thought, maybe I'll try this for real. So I went to journalism school at Columbia, and now I'm a journalist still.
The rest is history. How were your parents with that decision?
They were so livid with me. They were so, you know, they were truly disappointed and hurt, because they took very personally that I threw away the plan that they had helped build for me.
Yeah.
And I get that. I don't blame them for how much anger that they expressed when I quit the law firm. Because my parents are immigrants from Taiwan. They came to this country with no money, no, like hardly any English, very, very basic English, no friends, no family out here. And they were able to build a life. And part of building that, you know, that so-called American dream was to make sure that my brother and me would launch and be okay, would be financially stable, and would live a life that, you know, where we could make sure that we were physically and mentally healthy. And that's all they asked for, is that you know, we would one day be able to support ourselves, so we didn't have to worry, we didn't have to stress about money the way they always had to.
Yeah.
And I was, as far as they were concerned, I was poised to live out that life of stability and certainty and financial security, you know, as a lawyer. And when I just decided after I turned 30, never mind, they were just really, really disappointed. And it took a few years of me during this career transition, a few years of kind of just doing battle with them.
Yeah.
I constantly got the question from my father, are you sure you don't want to go back to law? Are you sure you want to be a journalist? You don't want to be a lawyer? I mean, he would ask me all the time. I would get very angry, I mean, annoyed to the point of getting angry, because he kept on repeating it. It was clearly on his mind for several years. And then when I was very clearly committed to journalism, then the question was, why don't you want to be on TV? Why radio? Don't you want to be like Connie Chung? TV is so much more money. Connie Chung is so famous. And I thought, no, Dad, I love the radio. I love the human voice.
Yeah.
I want to tell stories with my voice and listen to other people's stories through their voices. It's the voice that captivates me. So, it took several years, but they've come around to it. They've come around to it.
Let me reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking to NPR's All Things Considered host, Elsa Chang. I'm wondering, you know, having to grapple with your parents' disappointment on a career change And now you've elevated to this national position where you're talking to literally millions of people and many people have opinions. Did kind of navigating that disappointment with your folks, did that help you in terms of dealing with the criticism that you naturally get being a public figure?
All the time. But I want to answer that question a little more deeply.
Okay.
Reckoning with my parents' disappointment and criticism of my choice to quit the law profession, it taught me, because that was probably for me the most, up until then, the most painful experience I've ever gone through. You have to understand, like, seeking my parents' approval as a Taiwanese kid growing up in California was everything. It's what drove me to study really, really, really hard. I was always like a star student in school, wanting my parents to not only approve of what I was doing, but be impressed with my success, my achievement, really drilled into me this hunger to achieve for validation. It's, I don't mean to get all, you know, psychotherapeutic, or, you know, but I think I, through growing up like that, very much sought love through achievement, through concrete success. And so when I lost, for at least a period of time, my parents' approval, it wasn't just sad, it was soul crushing. It was, I felt adrift. I felt like if I don't have my parents' approval, what do I have?
Yeah.
You know? And I needed so much to show them that I could still achieve success, because I so much still wanted their love. And of course, looking back on this time, this is my 30s I'm talking about. Of course my parents still loved me all through that time. But sort of the signs of their love just were different, you know? I used to be the kid they always bragged about. But when I was going through those early years of being a journalist, they just talked about me less. And that was really hard for me. So to go back to your question, what going through that disconnect, that rupture with my parents did for me was force me to understand, teach me to understand that there are other ways, there are more important ways to learn how to love myself.
Sure.
And achievement, external validation is not how to get there anyway. I mean, believe me, I still want to do a good job. That still drives me, that fire to do good work. But I do it for different reasons now. I do it because now I'm in this profession, this vocation that does actually fulfill me internally. I love telling stories. I love teaching people about the world. And I find it deeply, profoundly meaningful when a story or an interview I do changes someone's life even a little bit. Maybe causes them to think a little harder about an issue, and they write and they tell me about that.
Yeah.
That for me is so deeply meaningful. So I think going through that rupture with my parents, that criticism of my parents, has helped me understand to look inward for love and to find meaning in different ways rather than external validation. Did that answer your question?
It does. And I'm actually going to follow up, because I'm wondering, do you use what you've learned through that interaction and through that learning of with your folks as a host, where a lot of times, and people may not realize this, sometimes you're not just asking questions, you're having a kind of an intimate relationship with someone. Do you use that, especially if it's a very difficult interview, a very emotional interview, where someone maybe is guarded and they may not be ready to necessarily share, and how you perhaps use some of that to draw them out?
Absolutely. It's not just with people who are guarded. A lot of people are just nervous being interviewed. I mean, I'm a little nervous being interviewed right now, not because of anything you're doing. It's hard to put yourself out there to have an open mic in front of you. I'm used to asking the questions, not answering them. It's a lot more vulnerable to answer questions. And so I'm very, I think now, sensitive to how scary it can be. My most important mission at the outset of an interview is to try to make the person feel comfortable. I mean, obviously every interview is different. There are certain people who I don't need to worry about their comfort because they're very used to speaking with the media, or they're in a position of power and accountability, you know, a public official, someone from within the White House or a member of Congress. I don't need to be there and babysit them and make sure that they are comfortable. They're used to this, and I'm not there to make them feel comfortable. But there are a lot of people who come onto our shows who are, because of what they're about to talk about, whether it be something painful or just something very private, yes, I very much can relate to feeling scared, insecure, uncertain, and anxious about what is my performance going to be like. And so I do try to make sure that people understand that I'm not there to get them.
Sure.
I'm there to coax them out of themselves so they can be their most interesting selves. That's my job. I very much believe that that is a host's job. The host is not there to grandstand and show audiences how good they are at talking. The host is there to make sure that the person they are talking to can be as compelling as possible. And part of that is to make the person feel comfortable.
You know, oftentimes we talk about, you know, athletes or celebrities or business leaders, you know, meeting the moment. And you shared this great story the other night when you were with us on Amplifying Oregon Voices, our campaign, about the live coverage you had to do when the convictions came down for the former president. And I want you to talk about that, but I also want to ask you this. Was there a moment where you thought, gee, Elsa, I'm one of a handful of people in the history of people covering the conviction of a former president of the United States?
Yes. Yes to that last question, which I'll talk more about.
Okay.
That moment did hit me. So we were just hosting the regular show, all things considered, me and my co-host Juana Summers. She's in Washington. I'm, of course, in Culver City, California. And we were just in the first half of the first hour, right? This is 4 p.m. Eastern now. I can't remember the exact minute that we started hearing the update that a verdict was reached, but it happened somewhere, I want to say, in the first half hour of the show. And we had already had a plan, a loose plan in place for months on what would we do when the verdict comes out in the New York trial. So there was at least some semblance of a plan, but you're never ready for the moment until the moment actually happens. And the question was, when do we break out of the show in that first hour and go into live special coverage? Because we didn't know what the verdict was. We just knew that a verdict was reached. It took only a few minutes for basically this vast team, not just of All Things Considered, but we have also a separate team that handles live special coverage at NPR. They basically banded together and they make a decision very quickly that we would break out of the show within, at that point, I think we had like, 5 minutes notice, we would just slip into live special coverage. And that, for people who don't understand what I'm talking about, is we just literally break out of the entire format of All Things Considered. All the newscast breaks, the segment breaks where you listen to interstitial music in between stories, we break out of all of that. And also, we break out of all the content that we had prepared throughout the day to air on the show. All of that just basically got swept away. I had pre-taped at that point because I knew I was hosting that day. I pre-taped a conversation with Dr. Ashish Jha, about, you know, what kind of COVID outbreak we might be facing this summer. I had also pre-taped a roundtable of our favorite science stories of the week. Mm-hmm. So all the stuff, and there were other things that Juana had pre-taped, all of those segments just evaporated. And we were basically, we slipped into a completely different mode. And live special coverage, you know, it varies by the event, but, you know, in terms of how prepared we are, that day, Thursday, that particular Thursday, we had some idea of what outside guests we would call immediately, like a handful of legal analysts, presidential historians, political analysts. We had a collection of people that we had reached out to almost by hotline and be like, okay, we're ready. This is the time. This is go time. But what was also challenging is, you know, not only do we go into live special coverage, but after that first burst of live special coverage is over, we knew we would have to go back and rebuild All Things Considered as a show, the 2-hour show, for the second and third feeds, right? Because there's, you know, three feeds to the show. And I was, of course, one of the hosts on tap that day, and I knew that we would have to build 2 new hours of programming from scratch. So you asked me, like, at what moment did it hit me? Wow, mm-hmm. I'm a part of history.
Yeah.
Honestly, it was at the top of the second feed. So this is 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific. Scott Detrow and I are now the hosts of the new revamped All Things Considered that's getting rebuilt, literally like a plane as it is flying in the air is getting built. We read the billboard live. That's at the top of the show where we promote the top stories. And that day there was only one top story. Trump, former president, has been convicted 34 times. We're reading the billboard live. And usually the billboard, for people who don't know, it's something that we pre-record. It's to music and it's very fast. So doing a live billboard synchronized to music is a different experience for even experienced hosts. So we're reading the billboard live, and then I'm the first host up to do a live interview. And I connect to Andrea Bernstein of NPR, who's outside the courthouse in Manhattan and basically telling us the scene in the courtroom as the word guilty was pronounced 34 times. And it was listening to Andrea narrate the scene and observing, recounting her observation that she saw Donald Trump give his son Eric a handshake, kind of like a very quick embrace, and seeing the expression on their faces pass between them. It was at that moment, listening to Andrea describe what she had seen from the courthouse, that it hit me like, wow. This is the first time in U.S. history a sitting or former president has ever been convicted of a crime. And here I am keeping our show on air, describing this just absolutely historic moment. That's when it happened for me.
When you sort of achieved or experienced that moment, you know, your job is very stressful, and I can imagine that there are all sorts of just highs and lows, and just, you know, frenetic energy and understanding how important what you're doing is, especially in a moment like that. Is it energizing for you? Forget about, I'm not talking about the politics or anything like that. It's just, my God, this is such an important story and I'm here. Is there a sense of like electricity that flows through you when that happens?
It is, to the extent where it's really hard for me to wind down after a show, specifically after a show about something like that.
Yeah.
I felt the same way after January 6, 2021. Sure. Mary Louise Kelly and I held the air for 6 straight hours in rolling live special coverage. That day with Trump's convictions, we held the air for 4 hours, almost 4 hours of live coverage. I do. It is, I guess, electric is one way to describe it. I'm amped up. My brain has been firing on all cylinders. I'm highly stimulated. It's really hard to wind down from that. And so I often, you know, I in both cases, I'm thinking about, well, January 6th, I was home hosting because it was at the height of the pandemic. But after that Thursday night when I came home, it took me hours and hours. I didn't fall asleep till that night, till almost 1 a.m., 1:30 a.m. Pacific. Not because I was like yapping on the phone or on the internet, like reading more about it. I just needed time to wind back down.
Yeah.
And yep, had to be up the very next morning and do it all over again.
Let me reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking to NPR's All Things Considered host, Elsa Chang. You know, I think my last question for you is this. And it's interesting, we're just talking about such important and serious coverage. But obviously, you know, yours is a voice that many people could say is quite different than maybe the stereotypical NPR voice. You bring so much energy and even, you know, kind of mirth sometimes, especially when you're talking to a celebrity or just something fun. Talk about that, because you did a great job at the event talking about, you know, advice you get about be yourself. And it's like, you're like, what does that mean? But I would ask you, you know, it's And you talked about your good friend Mary Louise Kelly, and she has a very perhaps a more traditional NPR or public radio voice. Yours is quite different. Talk about how you sort of unveiled that voice, that personality of yours, and how you kind of use it, because obviously for many of us, the driveway moments with you oftentimes are when you're talking to someone and we can hear the laughter in your voice, and we can hear just the fact that, you know, you're really happy to be there in that moment. Talk a little bit about
that. Thank you so much for saying that. I mean, you're feeding something inside me, because I love being my happier self on mic. I'm most comfortable being that happy, energetic, zippy self, because it's, it's kind of the way I am in real life. And I love
She
Mary
is,
Louise.
Folks, just in case you...
I love Mary Louise. You know, like, she's one of the hosts I absolutely love. I mean, I love co-hosting, and this is honest. I'm not just saying this for the public. I love each of my co-hosts. I particularly love co-hosting with Mary Louise because of the just sort of the quiet, calm confidence that radiates from her. I feel like it beams into me and I absorb it. I internalize it, and it lifts both of us up. But I did spend the beginning of my career as a host, you know, trying to sound more like the traditional NPR host, because of the tradition of Robert Siegel, Michelle Norris. Like, these were voices I very much admired. So I would lower my register. I would slow down. I would bring this, almost this external calm to my voice that wasn't inherent in my personality. But, you know, it's actually through people like you, Michael, who have approached me and said really, really kind, generous things about how they like it when I laugh on air, or they like when they hear little glimpses. They hear a glimpse, that's a bad mixed metaphor. When they hear little bits of my happier, peppier self, the goofier side of me, the funny side of me, the fun side of me. And that over time has let me just seize that permission to be more like the way I am in real life, which is loud and emphatic, sometimes a bit extra, certainly goofy, and I am a fun and funny person. I like being that way. And also, it's just such a relief to laugh on air. You know, as you know, being on air, sometimes you can hold a lot of tension. And if you're trying to keep your voice under complete lockdown control, it can be very hard to breathe and to keep your voice modulated without tremoring. And when you laugh, when you have this sudden burst of energy, it releases such physical tension. It's very freeing on air. Like, right now I'm doing it and it feels good and loud and happy.
I imagine for yourself, but also for your guest as well, because obviously that...
Yes.
Because obviously, like you just talked about, being the guest, there's a heightened sense of nervousness. And so that very human laughter can be very, very disarming.
Yeah, right. And you probably feel this way too as a host yourself. Like, when you are comfortable, people sense that. They know that and they feed off of that, and it makes them more comfortable usually, right? So I don't want, the last thing I want is to make the guest I'm talking to more self-conscious because I'm clearly being self-conscious, right?
Sure.
That's against both of our missions at that point. So yeah, I mean, you know, being an on-air host, it's the weirdest job. I imagine you can relate to this because everybody has an opinion about what you should sound like, what you should be like, how you should react in the moment, whether it's like your laugh is too loud or you're too serious or you're too combative. I get feedback all the time about what I'm supposed to be like. And then at the same time, people are saying, oh, just be yourself, though. Just be yourself. Just be authentic. And you're like, what do you even want? What does that even mean? And it is doing this job year after year over the course of a while that you start to settle into a persona. It's still a persona, right? Like, you're still parts of yourself, but you're not your whole self. You can't be your whole self as a journalist on mic. But you learn what to settle into and accept and love about yourself. There is a self-acceptance journey that happens for an on-air host that kind of parallels what happens in real life for most of us.
Indeed, indeed. Well, Elsa Chang, the All Things Considered host for NPR, really appreciate you making time for us coming in and talking. It's been just a delight to listen to you.
Thank you so much. This was such a pleasure, Michael.
That's the show for today. As you heard, Elsa Chang is an incredibly interesting, insightful, and just generally fun person to talk to. I'm Michael Dunn, and this has been Oregon on the Record from KLCC. Thanks for listening.